Okay, right, I've had the good look at you, and I'm guessing that not many of you have spent time in an active war zone or backpacking in South America? Regular group sex? No. Okay, that makes you the perfect audience, because I haven't done any of those things either. In fact, I've had a very unexciting and colourless life, really. And I sometimes wake at 4 in the morning with a terrifying thought, nothing is happening. I'm getting no experience. I will die without ever having lived. Luckily, at other times, I have another thought, which is that my life has been really strange, a peculiar conundrum that I still don't understand. And it's that second feeling that I want to encourage, of course. And so I wrote a book called Embracing the Ordinary, really to convince myself that my conventional and circumscribed life has not been entirely in vain. The key word, of course, is experience. We all crave experience, need experience, but we tend to think of experience as what rather than how. So it's what you do rather than how you relate to it. So if you're short of experience, the answer is embark on a love affair with someone from another generation, race, or culture, preferably all three, or give up your job and walk from Cali to Istanbul, as a friend of mine is doing. A high-flying lawyer who's just given up his job. This is the what solution. There's also the how solution, which is to change the way you experience. And this involves not seeing new things in the old way, but seeing old things in a new way. It's really a matter of changing perception. It's a belief of mine that experience can be deepened as well as widened. So how do we enrich perception? That's the question. Luckily enough, there are lots of ways of doing this, and we need all of them. But broadly speaking, it comes down to the arts or philosophy, and science can even help. Not too sure about religion, but we'll come to that in a minute. So the arts, really, I would think, have been the most useful for this, because the arts embrace the ordinary earlier on and in a wider variety of ways. And the story of how that developed would make a very interesting talk. Several talks, 100 talks. But I've got to remind myself this is a philosophy festival, so for the deep thinkers, we will stick to philosophy. What was philosophy's contribution? Well, it got off to a flying start with the Stoics. Seneca said, "It is characteristic of a great soul to scorn what is great and prefer what is ordinary." And Marcus Aurelius put this into practice by praising things like crusty bread, olives, figs. He loved the way figs split. But after that, things went a bit quiet. In fact, totally silent for many centuries. And in fact, much subsequent philosophy has taken the opposite view, that everyday life isn't worth considering. For instance, Marx's view that modern life is alienated and debased has been hugely influential, and so has Heidegger's notion of everydayness as mediocrity, and equally Sartre's dismissal of everyday life as inauthentic and conformist. So it was really only in the second half of the 20th century that thinkers actually began to think about ordinary life, to find it worthy of consideration. And one example of this is Michel de Certeau's book, The Practice of Everyday Life. De Certeau was French, so his book actually is more high-flown theory than actual ordinary life. But he does have one great idea, I think, a thing he calls the ruse. This means taking some aspect of everyday life, some function or role that you're obliged to do for other people, and turning it around for your own benefit, appropriating it. And his idea was that the ruse is transgressive, even subversive. And subversion is what makes things exciting. If we're told something is worthy and dutiful, we faint with boredom. But if we think it's subversive, we're thrilled. So what would be a good example of a ruse? Well, the most perfect example I know was in a movie I saw back in the 1960s called Cool Hand Luke, with Paul Newman as Luke. And Luke was one of a gang of convicts spreading gravel on a dirt road in the deep south of America, and doing it as slowly as possible, of course. But then suddenly Luke got this idea and started spreading gravel with manic zest, really going at it. And the other convicts didn't know what he was up to begin with. But then one by one, they started to copy him. And then soon they were all doing it. They were all throwing shovels of gravel like madmen. And they actually ran out of road and just fell about laughing hysterically. Well, the guards, of course, were furious. They didn't know what was going on. They thought it was some kind of plot, escape plot. So that is the perfect ruse, because it took an obligation that's the most appalling you can imagine, forced hard labor, and turned it into something personal and subversive. And we can all do this in a mild way, not exactly with forced hard labor, but in the workplace, it's possible to do things with a little more enthusiasm than is absolutely necessary, and with a slightly peculiar kind of enthusiasm, which is definitely not necessary. And this disconcerts bosses tremendously. They really do not know what you're up to. They're more used to complaint, reluctance, and feet dragging and all that kind of thing. So the workplace, in fact, is a great environment for the ruse. I used to really enjoy photocopying my poems on the company machine. And for those of a non-artistic temperament, there was the possibility of photocopying their genitals on the company machine. So many possibilities in work, and meetings were always the thing I dreaded most. But eventually it occurred to me that the answer to meetings was to treat them as satirical one-act plays staged expressly for my benefit. And that was pretty good. But then after that, got another idea, which was to use the meeting as a venue for cliche spotting. So people would go out with wellies and binoculars to spot birds, or go to meetings to collect cliches. And there aren't very many new species of birds, but cliches spring eternal. New cliches pop up all the time. They're a bit like jokes in that respect. Nobody seems to invent them, but they keep appearing. So wonderful scope for cliche spotting. So there's the ruse and the cliche. And for De Certeau's idea of the ruse, I've got that reduced to something you could put on a t-shirt, a coffee mug, or a fridge magnet. Ruse it or lose it. And I collect ruses and cliches, by the way. So instead of asking me questions afterwards, if you give me some new ruses and cliches, I'd be thrilled. But that's only one idea. Something that's probably more generally useful, I think, is process philosophy, which is a branch of philosophy that also developed in the 20th century and has flourished largely in the USA. And the beauty of this is that it's based on one really, really simple idea. But it's a simple idea with exhilarating implications, I think. In fact, it's not a new idea. It's really a very, very old idea. It goes all the way back to Buddha and Heraclitus. And when an old idea pops up again in a new form like that, you begin to think there's something in it. So what is this wonderfully simple idea? It's the view that everything is process. There is nothing solid, no stuff, nothing final, no end states. Everything is process. Reality is motion. There is nothing but flux. And this can be a disturbing idea for many people. But it's also a productive idea to imagine that, or to think that everything really is one gigantic mega process made up of lots of maxi processes, made up in turn of mini processes, made up of micro processes, and so on, all the way down to the weird heart of reality, the heart of matter, and all the way out to the equally weird far end of the madly expanding universe. And interacting and overlapping and combining with all this is the other equally weird mega process of human consciousness, which itself is made up of maxi processes, etc., etc., etc. Get the idea? And this can be, as I was saying, both alarming and counterintuitive. People think, well, if everything's moving, if everything's motion, if everything's changing, what is it to hang on to? Won't we be just swept away in the flood? And what's this about nothing being solid or permanent or stable? You know, that's solid, isn't it? Solid. Well, actually, isn't that solid? Isn't the universe permanent, eternal? Isn't the self stable? Well, the process philosophers would say no, no, and no. One of the first of them was Henri Bergson, and he's really the inventor of, not really the inventor, but the first modern philosopher to think in this way. And Bergson claimed that nothing is solid, not even atoms. And this was back in the 1890s, so it was an incredibly daring thing to say, because this was before even the splitting of the atom. And people thought he was mad, of course, but then 20 years or so later, along came quantum mechanics to prove he was right. And everything, I'm not a physicist, so my knowledge of physics is not perfect, but as I understand it, physics now believes this, that reality at the bottom level is actually some kind of weird dance of energy. There's actually nothing there, which is a slightly bizarre thought, but that's what they say. And similarly, the notion of an eternal universe got knocked on the head by the discovery of the Big Bang and the idea that everything developed from a point and it's expanding out in every direction, and will eventually, they say, peter out in dust. So the universe is in the same boat as the rest of us, actually. Dust thou art, and unto dust thou shalt return. And the other thing they discovered is that the universe seemed to be inert and empty, whereas now they say it's full of something weird called dark energy. So it's all seething and writhing about out there, really. So what does this tell us? The nothing, the something, is actually nothing, and the nothing is actually something. Which is weirder, the cosmos or the atom? It's a good question. I think of God cackling to himself up there. Which is more wacko, the micro or macro? And of course, the stable self has been knocked on the head by neuroscience, which tells us that there's no such thing as a self. The self is a master of self-deception, and its greatest feat is convincing itself it exists. There really is no stable self. It's all a flux of consciousness, a series of psychological experiences, and we construct this notion of a self for our own comfort. So what my wife said could never happen has actually come about. I'm selfless at last. Okay, I know what you're thinking at this point. What has all this got to do with property values and hey on why? Where's the connection to everyday life? We suddenly shot off into the universe there. Well, let me give you one practical example. Because we're so alarmed and disturbed by the process view of things, we tend to think of things in terms of objects and end states. So this creates all kinds of problems because these don't exist. So, for instance, we think that success in love is a matter of finding the right person, the object, and that this will automatically bring about the desired end state, undying love. Well, as if for the first part, and for the second part, and even louder, as if. There is no right person, and there is no end state. When you find someone, your problems are only beginning. Love is the ultimate process. It involves endless work. It's either getting better or it's getting worse, but it's never static. So that's one example. But more generally, there's the common problem of depression, a feeling of monotony and stale repetition, a sort of crushing sameness, a sense that nothing is happening and nothing can ever change, nothing can ever provide sustenance. This is the feeling I was talking about earlier. And the beauty of process philosophy is that it knocks that on the head completely. It dispels that view by telling us that there's no such thing as repetition. There's no such thing as sameness. The same circumstances never repeat. And this, of course, is the famous axiom of Heraclitus, isn't it? No one steps into the same river twice. Bergson's version of this was the same does not remain the same, which he found immensely reassuring, and so do I. So, if we think in this way, Bergson said, if we think of reality as essentially motion, then ordinary life will be both illuminated and nourished. Everything that seems static will begin to seem dynamic. Everything that is frozen will start to thaw. Everything around us will become more interesting. Everything within us will be revitalized. We will live more fully, he said finally. And that is really the beauty of process philosophy. But then later, Bergson went one further than that, and he said, life is not only constant change, it's constant creation. Life invents and creates. It doesn't just change, it actually creates elaborate newness. And he described this phenomenon with the phrase élan vital, which was very unfortunate because everybody immediately assumed this was something mystical and dismissed his ideas as mystical claptrap, rubbish. And that remained the case for a long time, but science has proved him right again. In the last 20 or 30 years ago, there's been a really interesting new scientific paradigm. which is the paradigm of emergence. And emergence explains or attempts to explain how complexity arises from simplicity, order from chaos, life from inanimate matter. And this really began with biologists thinking about organisms and the way organisms adapt to their environment and every now and then suddenly make a complete change up to a higher level of complexity for no apparent reason. And the great example of this would be human consciousness, which arrived at some point as an accidental development. And you can feel about this in two opposite ways. You can either regard this as a triumph or a disaster. But you certainly can't envisage going back. There's no getting rid of it. We're stuck with consciousness for better or worse, so why not regard it as a triumph? But emergence applies not just to living things, but also to societies in general, to economies, to cities. These are all examples of complexity arising by itself, arising out of simplicity, order developing out of disorder, self-organization, creative networks exploding and developing in all kinds of unpredictable ways. And again, you're sitting there thinking, yes, yes, all right, it's gone off on another weird tangent. Now what's the relevance of this? If everything is so weird and wonderful and unpredictable, how come we keep waking up in the morning thinking same old shit again? Well, the answer that Bergson and many others would give to that is that we're deadened by habit and convention, a combination of these two things. And we're then overwhelmed by the utilitarian demands of everyday life. It's very easy to concentrate only on the practical realities of getting through the day, your job and your family life usually. And it's also very easy to succumb to all kinds of social pressures. So habit and convention are major themes, and not just in philosophy, by the way. These are major themes of Proust as well. Proust and Bergson actually said very much the same thing. Introverts are more at risk from habit, probably. Extroverts more at risk from convention. So staying in and going out are equally dangerous. William James, in fact, said that by the age of 25 or so, we're just walking bundles of habit and convention. Proust was even more pessimistic. He said that we begin to petrify immediately after childhood. And it's certainly true that the threat grows with age. Petrifaction is age-related. And I'm acutely aware of this myself because I see the phenomenon in many of my contemporaries. And really, it's my most fervent wish not to suffer the same fate. So I'm petrified of becoming petrified. And it's not just that being petrified shuts you off from experiencing many things. It's that it makes life extremely unpleasant for everyone around you also. Partners, family, friends, colleagues, and so on. And petrified people tend to suffer from rage as well, because obviously they're trying to resist change, and yet there are manifestations of change all around which they can't control. So this makes them very angry. And as well as the anger, there's often stinginess, both material and emotional. Along with the refusal to take anything in, there's a refusal to give anything out. But in fact, change is unavoidable. Resistance to change is itself change. And that change is hardening, petrifaction. So you can either fool along with the change or try to resist it, but change in a less productive way, petrify. There's also a gender issue here, I think. Men seem to be more at risk from a kind of spiritual Alzheimer's. That's mostly my male contemporaries who are becoming petrified. Nothing is changing, rages the angry young man. Everything is changing, rages the angry old man, who then retreats into a sort of shell of eccentricity and peevishness. And I think women may escape this by being more willing to immerse in life, go along with the flow, to develop along with their children and then with their grandchildren. But before the women in the audience start getting too smug, I think women have the other problem, which is if you're more inclined to immerse in life, then you're more likely to suffer from being deadened by convention. You're more likely to uphold conventional behavior. So men are at risk from habit, women are at risk from convention. We are all in constant danger. We must all be on constant petrifaction alert. How do you do that? That's the question. How do we avoid petrifaction? Well, again, there are many possible ways of doing this, and again, we need all of them. One of the first things that occurred to me that when I thought about this was that common cause of petrifaction is self-importance. If you believe you're important, then you have very little incentive to change. And in fact, you believe it's the people around you who should change. They should adapt to you rather than you adapting to them. And the answer to this problem is to have a keen sense of the comic and the absurd. Life is the comic novel of God. And we are all his absurd characters. And if we refuse to laugh, we may end up being punished. God may turn us to stone. So, comedy is one answer. Philosophy hasn't been very good at acknowledging the comic vision. Wittgenstein once had an idea. He thought it would be great to write a philosophy book made up completely of jokes, which would have been terrific, of course. The only snag was he had no sense of humor. So he never got as far as the first joke. And not many other philosophers are funny, let's face it. I'm sure he didn't come here for laughs. Bergson wasn't funny either. But at least he wrote a good book about comedy. And Bergson's theory was that comedy has evolved specifically in order to prevent or break down petrifaction by making it laughable, by exposing petrified people as figures of fun. It's an interesting theory of comedy. It doesn't quite cover all of comedy, I don't think, but some comedy. Not all comedy is equally useful in this way. Most comedy tends to be very coarse-grained. It's based on caricature and farce, invention, exaggeration. A much more useful type of comedy is a comedy that approaches very closely to real life. And this kind of comedy allows us to empathize with people rather than feeling superior to them. It's the kind of comedy that makes you groan as well as laugh because you recognize people. You recognize them all too well. People you know in situations you know suffering from delusions that are all too familiar. And the master of this comedy, I think, is the filmmaker Mike Leigh. So if you want an example of the comedy of recognition, watch almost any Mike Leigh movie. And the consequence of this kind of comedy is that unconsciously you become aware of things. You become aware that you may petrify and that petrifaction is comic and absurd. And therefore, you start paying attention to life. This is what Bergson said. The purpose of comedy, ultimately, is to make us pay attention. And that is the key to everything, really. That is also the key to perception. We can consciously attempt to pay attention as well. And this was the major theme of William James, the American philosopher. Experience, James said, is nothing other than what we pay attention to, which is one of these very simple insights that seem so obvious once you've heard them. And Bergson, who was a great friend of William James, agreed. He actually said the purpose of philosophy is to teach us to pay attention. And in particular, to pay attention to the things that we would normally disregard. So he said philosophy gives us the theory, the arts give us the examples. So philosophy teaches us to know what we know but don't know that we know. And the arts teach us to see what we see but don't know that we see. I hope you got that, because I'd never get it right a second time. So that's where the arts and philosophy sort of overlap in the paying of attention. And there can be a tremendous payoff for this in the phenomenon known to the arts as the epiphany, to psychology as the peak experience, and to religion as a mystical state. This phenomenon is so different from ordinary experience that it's common to interpret it as the intervention of some otherworldly force, mysticism in other words. But you can interpret it in a purely secular way. You can interpret the phenomenon as simply ordinary perception heightened to maximum intensity, turbo perception. It's only possible for very short periods. And for that brief moment, we become fully awake and aware. And reality is revealed in its full glory. And this really is as good as it gets. It's actually very hard to experience and very rare, so that's not surprising. But we can possibly inch our way towards it by heightening perception a little bit and deepening experience a little bit, and possibly learning that it's all more interesting and mysterious and comical than we ever imagined. So go forth and embrace the ordinary.